Ladies and gentlemen, I'm welcoming to the Salieri Report someone who needs no introduction, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who has served the United States with great distinction as a military leader, also served as Chief of Staff to the Secretary of the State, and is now a professor at William and Mary and beyond, and I think is one of the most balanced, intelligent voices. I'm always interested, Colonel Wilkerson, not only in how many requests we get to get you back on the Salieri Report, but it's invariably from our most intelligent and curious subscribers.
Wow.
The higher the IQ, the more they want you. Anyway, so we have many questions for you today because clearly national security is front and center. But I'd like to start with the future of NATO. Certainly the events in Europe and with the Ukraine has really put NATO front and center in a lot of people's minds. But just if you could give us 2 minutes on what is NATO and then where do you think it's going?
My appreciation of NATO for Secretary Powell and earlier for Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Powell when I was special assistant to him in the early 90s was that it was an anachronism. It didn't need to be around anymore, that no alliance, no matter how successful politically and militarily, and NATO could be argued to be one of the most successful in human history, could survive and indeed would do more harm than good after its threat was gone. Obviously, virtually everyone disagreed with me and said, no, we must find an external purpose for NATO, that is to say, out of area operations, which was the term of art at the time. And so we started finding things like the Balkans, ultimately Afghanistan, and so forth. I still adhere to my original forecast, if you will, that NATO no longer has a reason for existence, and we seem to be scratching around hard in Ukraine and elsewhere trying to find one. That's a dismal projection, perhaps, especially if it's been so successful, but I think it's a realistic assessment.
Okay. Now, we've also heard a great deal about the pivot to Asia with increased economic interests in the South China Sea and Asia rising. It's clear the military is planning or is in the process of shifting more resources out to Asia. What is the pivot to Asia?
So far, as my Japanese, Korean, and even Chinese colleagues will tell me and do tell me, not much. As a matter of fact, I was just talking with a good friend who used to be head of a very large Japanese enterprise in the United States. He's now back in Tokyo. We had lunch the other day, and he was talking to me about Prime Minister Abe coming to the Japanese Prime Minister to address a joint session of Congress. And we were discussing what Prime Minister Abe might say that would resonate with Americans and yet still be true to the message he wants to deliver for Japan. And we got into a conversation about how the pivot to Asia was not felt in Asia. That is to say, there hasn't been much change, and in Seoul, in Tokyo, and I think probably in Beijing too, and other capitals, Canberra being one of them, people think that the focus on the Middle East is still there. It's bifurcated now, if you will, with another focus on Ukraine, as you pointed out earlier. And so the United States is still looking that way. Now, the one thing I think, and Patrick Cronin has a good piece this morning on this, that would change that is if the Trans-Pacific Partnership and TPA along with it were given real credibility, were put in force by the Congress, was signed, as it were, and we got this massive trade agreement with the Pacific region, which has really become, I think, more a security agreement than it is a trade agreement. Of course, it's got the trade aspects to it, too. But for Japan, at least, it has become a statement of what the United States means in terms of staying in the Pacific. We can't be seen, in other words, by friends and foes alike as just a military power, as just interested in the hard power. We've got to be interested in regaining, many would say, the Japanese included, our prominence in the Asia-Pacific region in economic and financial matters. Our screwed-up approach to the Asian Infrastructure Bank is a great example. We should have welcomed that with open arms. We should have been right there saying, yes, we're going to be a member too, and encourage Britain and Germany and others, Australia, to be members. This is China growing up to be a responsible regional and global stakeholder, and we should be right there with them. We shouldn't have given this message of negativity.
Well, there's no doubt if the world needs more infrastructure. And if you look at all the projections of infrastructure development, the question is, how are we going to do it? And if we're not going to do it, then they need to do it. But clearly, if you look at the size, everybody's going to have to be a part of this if it's going to happen.
Absolutely. As Patrick pointed out this morning in his article, my goodness, if you're talking about not being a member, or you're fighting it, or you're saying you will only take money from us and you've got no money to give, you're in a hard place.
Right. Well, speaking of that, we see Japan committing to increase their military spending in coordination with us, and indication that other Asian allies will. Is this us being willing to collaborate and let the others into, so because we need them to pick up the tab?
I think that's part of it, but part of it also is we have to face the realities of what's happened in the way of success of our post-World War II policies. Whether it's Germany and Europe in general, or whether it's Asia and Japan in specific, our policies have been remarkably successful. And as a consequence of that, others' power has increased relative to our own. At the same time, ours has inevitably decreased. I say inevitably because it was inevitable that we would lose some power. We were the new Rome post-World War II with 50% plus of the world's GDP. We couldn't possibly hold on to that. And lately, we've done a lot through really bad leadership to decrement our own power. The case in point being most prominent, strategic mistake in invading Iraq and releasing all the things we've released there by our having destroyed the balance of power, which we painstakingly maintained ever since FDR, with the Shah first and then with the standoff between the Persians and the Arabs after the Shah fell. So we destroyed that balance of power and made a mess. We've decremented our own power. But right. It is inevitable that the power situation in the world is going to become more equitable, if you will. And in that situation, we need to be more cooperative, more collaborative, and we need to help. And Japan and other allies need to do the same thing. I think Prime Minister Abe realizes that and is trying to do it.
Now, given the mistake is made, so we are where we are, given where we are, do you think the Iran deal that the administration is trying to organize will help get us out?
I don't know. I haven't seen the full details of it. No one has. I'm not even sure that Rouhani and Zarif on the Iranian side and Obama and Kerry on the American side even know what the final deal will look like. But there's enough now that's perspective to tell me that if we can put this together, if the technical details as per brief can be worked out, this is a far better alternative to war. And war is the only other real alternative. People will say containment is an option. We can just keep the sanctions on and so forth. Well, Iran's not going to sit there and twiddle their thumbs while we do that. They're simply going to make the decision, and they're going to go nuclear, and we're going to be able to do nothing about it except bomb. Bombing, at best, even combined with the Israelis, would set Iran's program back 5 to 7 years and make them nationally cohesive in terms of what they wanted to do after that bombing, and that would be build a nuclear weapon and never have it happen again. So you then have the option, and the sole option, if you find that unacceptable, and we've said we do, to invade. That's 500,000 troops, 10 years, $2 to $3 trillion, and as Anthony Zinni, former commander of Central Command, said so eloquently, if you liked Iraq, you'll love Iran. We're talking about 75 million people, 51% of whom are Persian, very cohesive, demographically, geographically, militarily, far superior to Iraq. It would be a real hard nut to crack. I'm not saying it couldn't, but it would look like Iraq or worse at the end of that decade. So what have you gained? This is the best deal we can get if we can get it.
Well, it looks, you know, if you look at what's happening with Cuba and what's happening with Iran, it almost looks like the U.S. realizes it's overextended, it's made mistakes, and now it's just trying to close the open door so that it can manage that which it can manage. It's overextended, and it needs to back down, and it needs to shift resources to being a protective global citizen.
I think you're right. I think you're right, and it's, if it's done wisely, if it's done judiciously, I think that's the best course of action. I'm somewhat alarmed that my party, the Republican Party, I listened to Marco Rubio yesterday, seems to think, mostly through platitudes, which are meaningless, no substance to them, but seems to think that they can reach back into the past and resurrect the old America, that is the hegemon of the world, the power that did exist in 1945 and even then began bleeding its power on the day the war ended. I think that's very dangerous to think that way, but it's very resonating with the American people, or at least a significant portion of them. Sad to say that the apathy in this country, the ignorance in this country, and the general indolence about the political process concerns me as much as people like Rubio and like others in my political party who seem to think that the golden days of the past are just that, golden and resurrectable. I don't even know if they were golden in the true sense of that term, but they certainly featured us being the dominant power in the world. I think those days are over, and I think we need to get used to it. And after all, we lived in a world where two of the greatest empires in the world at the time, for at least our first 50 years, were trying to rape, pillage, and plunder us in any way they could. And Spain wasn't doing too bad a job either. So this isn't anything new. This is just kind of returning to being not primus inter pares, but not primus at all, but just a whole lot of powers that are trying to get along in the world, trying to meet the challenges of climate change, for example, and other huge challenges we have, like 9 billion people by mid-century.
Right.
These are huge challenges, and we're not going to meet them individually, and we're not going to meet them with bombs, bullets, and bayonets either.
Right. I couldn't agree more. The Iran deal, what does it mean for Europe?
I think for Europe, as France, Germany, and the UK have demonstrated by their more or less soft approach to it, with Hollande in Paris being somewhat different at times, wanting to keep his Saudi contacts warm and keep the Israelis warm. I think they've been very important to this process. They've given it solidity. They've given it legitimacy. And I think they're looking forward, as are China and Russia, to better relations with Iran, particularly in the area of trade and commerce.
Right, it's smack dab in the middle.
Yeah. No.
What about
no missiles, please? Just money.
What about Israel? Because it looks to me like the Israelis have gotten their head handed to them. Something I'd love to have seen happen much sooner. But you know, am I right in that assessment?
I hope you are. And I would. My own view is that Bibi Netanyahu and his clan, his clique, the 1 in 5 Israelis that's now a settler, the greater Israel people, the Russian emigres to a large extent, I hope they're getting it handed to them. And I hope they don't do something that's going to be a strike in the dark, but nonetheless very dangerous, like, for example, do something vis-a-vis Iran themselves. I think that would be catastrophic. I see Bibi's whole posture as being threatening in the mid and long term to the state of Israel, both physically and spiritually in terms of its Jewish stateness. I don't see that he can maintain either physical security or a Jewish state doing what he's doing. It seems to me to be absolutely self-evident. So I have to believe that what Bibi's doing is staying in power, and that's it. He doesn't care about the future, because he's endangering Israel's future by the policies he's promoting and the policies he has promoted to this point.
Well, it certainly looks to me like he's losing a lot of support among the American Jewish population, which has normally been very supportive of Israel.
I find that true. I find anywhere between 60 and 65% of the American Jewish community wishing him gone.
Right. Right, so you almost wonder where is his base?
Sheldon Adelson, the Macau casinos, billions of dollars, Paul Singer, and a few others. I mean, he's got a hugely, hugely well-financed base, let's put it that way.
Right. Well, you know, the hypocrisy of it, because after all, Israel is a nuclear power. So
yes,
the Iranians didn't try and do this to the Israelis when they developed nuclear capacity.
And it's really not about nuclear weapons. It's all about who's going to be the power in the Gulf. It's that way with the Saudis. It's that way with Tehran. It's that way with Tel Aviv. And who's going to be the person, the individual leader, but the country ultimately, backed by the United States from time to time when the United States feels its interests are being impacted. And Israel does not want that to be anybody but them. Riyadh does not want that to be anybody but them. And Tehran is looking for a rapprochement that might put them back in the seat they were in for 25 years when the Shah ran the place. And the United States and Iran got along pretty well. I don't think they want that close a relationship, but they would like to have a much better relationship, which threatens, they feel, the Saudis and the Israelis, the U.S. relationship with them. And so it's not the nukes are really a surface matter. I know that sounds crazy, but they are. It's all about who's going to be the power in the Gulf.
Well, and part of it is, you know, as the trade between Asia and Europe grows, everybody in the middle is competing for a bigger flow.
Yeah.
So
you look at the pipelines under construction, gas and oil, the pipelines contemplated and the pipelines already pumping, and look at how they are going to create the conflict of the future, and you understand what this is all about viscerally in terms of who gets what from whom and when and who makes money off of it. I mean, the pipelines are sort of analogous to, for fleets, navies, the old coaling stations and so forth. You know, that and water, put that in water together and you've got the next 50 years of either well-led, reasonably managed peace, or you've got, as Haas has pointed out, increasing disorder.
What if energy supplies start flowing from Iran to Europe? What does that mean to Russia?
I think it means that Europeans, and particularly, specifically right now at this moment, Ukraine and maybe the Baltic countries and others that might eventually suffer the little green men from Putin, have a lot more independence. And a lot more capability to stand up to him and to not be so cowed by his ability to bring energy into the picture and threaten their very existence. I think that's what we're looking at in terms of, at least partly in terms of us seeking a rapprochement with Tehran, because we can build pipelines. Some are already contemplated. One, as I recall seeing, I think, at ExxonMobil's rooms, going out of Iran and up to India. And, of course, you can go further. You can branch off also. So you're going to get these lines running east and west and these lines running north and south. And you're going to look at them and you're going to see China's trying to gain some independence from single sourcing. India is trying to gain some independence from single sourcing. Russia wants everybody, but isn't going to get everybody, and is fighting this change from single sourcing that others are trying to do. And Iran's in the middle with lots of gas and a little oil. Well, not a little oil. They got quite a bit of oil. So this is the future, how these all play out in terms of handling and managing them in a peaceful way, a cooperative, collaborative way, or fighting over them. I pointed out before that the strategic group at Shell, for whom I have a lot of respect, Royal Dutch Shell, briefed me a couple of years ago, and part of their plan was to put aside some money to fund private security forces to protect their pipelines, because they didn't think governments were going to do this very well.
Well, it's the Swedish Institute that tracks global military expenditures just came out with their latest announcement for 2013. We spent $1.7 trillion, which is essentially constant since 2007 a year, and you look at that number, and then you look at the exploding debt, and you say, you know, we can't afford this. And the reality is, if we could build a cooperation or a cooperative way for everybody not to be energy dependent, but to, you know, to have multiple and diversified bases, maybe we could spend a lot less on energy, on security. So the idea that all these companies have to go do private security forces, it's just terrifying.
It is. I just read this morning a bright light in an otherwise dismal picture. I don't know if your listeners or you saw this. The Nusra Square, the horrific killings in Nusra Square in Iraq and by Blackwater guards. Those four guards, the instigator, the one who fired the first round, was given life, and the other three were given 30 years each. As I said, that's some justice, I guess, in the middle of what was really a catastrophe.
I saw the headline, but I was very curious because so much of the private contracting structure, my understanding is that it's been put in place to shield private companies from liability. So I'm amazed at how they engineered that.
It did.
I don't know what the...
Yeah, I think the hue and cry was just so great that legal authorities, especially in this country, dared not back away from it without figuring out some way to punish them.
Who was the prosecutor? Do you know?
I haven't read the article completely. I downloaded it,
right.
But I want to do that. I want to see how they did this because, as you might suspect, I have very deep concerns about how we prosecute people for doing things,
right.
Even if
right.
they're powerful.
Right. Right. Well, the I will say this: the contract, the non-accountability created by contractors, and the contracting infrastructure was to me particularly frightening, so I find this very curious. But
DOD aided and abetted it. I have to admit, I was there when we started this process, and it does a number of things for DOD. It gets them around the in-strength restrictions on the armed forces
right.
placed by the Congress. We could never have done Afghanistan and Iraq simultaneously without 200,000-plus contractors.
Right.
And it does what you just said. It gives you a body of men and some women whom you can employ in ways that are almost immune from prosecution. And so you don't get tied up in either the Uniform Code of Military Justice on the one hand or whatever host country's laws or your laws on the other hand. And so they're sort of immune and can do things that military and others can't do. It's a very nice deal for DOD, although they're discovering that the cost of it is just out of this world, and they're trying to cut back on the contracts now because the cost is not
right.
advertised.
Well, but here's it's a bigger problem, and I won't hang on it, but if you look across the entire economy, and defense is far from alone in this, what we've done is we've created a private sector which is entirely organized and dependent on government mandates and can't function outside of government mandates. And you're having a real problem with the private sector now vested in getting government to create more mandates because they don't believe in markets.
You're
so,
right. And prisons yeah. is one of the places where I point at all the time. We actually have lobbyists now who are lobbying the Congress for more draconian laws so people stay in jail more often or longer. I mean, it's absurd.
Right.
We have the most full prisons in the world. And
well, once upon a time, my company was a government contractor, and what I learned was we should fire most of them and make them government employees if we're going to do it.
Yeah. Well, we've privatized some of the ultimate public functions.
Right. I'm not
the ultimate public function.
Okay, so at the end of last year, Richard Haass, head of the Council on Foreign Relations, published an article called The Unraveling, which I thought was a very interesting overview of the struggle by the U.S. to maintain the Bretton Woods system and the challenges and the sort of political goings on within the United States among the leadership. And I sent it to you and discovered you're going to teach in Italy shortly and you're using it as part of your coursework. Maybe if you could talk a little bit about what is the unraveling and what does it mean for what's going to happen over the next few years.
I think Richard's point well taken in one respect, is that what we have is not a new world order to replace the more or less bipolar order of the Cold War, where two great powers, the Soviet Union and the United States, confronted each other and sort of everybody else subscribed to one or the other, or became a member of the non-aligned movement, and it was, you know, relatively peaceful. And what we have now is a new world disorder, and that disorder is going to, it's probably going to persist for some time to come. And it involves a number of factors, some of which we've already talked about, the dissipation of power of the great powers and the equalization to a certain extent of that power amongst others, like Brazil, Russia, India, China, the so-called BRIC countries and so forth, but others too. And the scramble that's occurring over what could in many respects be dwindling resources like water, oil, gas, and so forth, and is going to intensify. And the lack of state entities to deal with that, what started with Westphalia in 1648 and probably came to its fruition with the creation of the United Nations to manage that state structure even better, especially in terms of warfare and so forth and development, and the international financial institutions better to fund the building and the flourishing of these state structures and so forth. What we have now, Richard would say, I think, is lots of structures out there, if you can even call them structures, that aren't like that. They aren't state structures. And, of course, the most prominent ones are Al-Qaeda and ISIS and groups like them, which seem to be blooming all over the world. I would take a little bit of exception to that prognosis, and especially that it will persist for a long time, simply because of the things that, for example, I heard this morning on a TED Talk by none other than the head of the Dutch Defense Force, the chief of the Dutch Defense Force. He walked on the stage with a rifle, and he started talking about a gun and what a gun does. He doesn't like guns. He doesn't like what guns do, but he understands that guns, in other words, armed forces, are necessary from time to time, and that they can be a force for positive, a force for good. And I would say the Dutch armed forces sort of aim at that. It is a really great talk because it sort of hits at the United States and its use of force and its possession of guns out the yin-yang. At the same time, it's saying that such security forces as he represents and as the United States represents in huge form are necessary. And that they're necessary for protection of this state structure. And I think he's right. And I think if it's done wisely, if it's done smartly, if it's done efficiently, that is to say, not too much blood and treasures expended doing it, then we can arrest this tendency within a decade or two, and we can go back, if you will, to the kind of peaceful state structure that seems to, through the state's control of force, do a better job of maintaining an equilibrium in the world, a stability under which people can become more prosperous, more successful, exercise their creativity and entrepreneurial rights and so forth, and ultimately spread people power. I know that sounds a little utopian, but I think this chief of the Dutch Defense Force,
that's a great speech. I've seen him.
I think he's right to a certain extent. And I love the way he was throwing the barbs out as well as the kudos, because it's clear that he was saying, you haven't done that very well. You happen to be the biggest policeman on the block in the United States, but lately you've been shooting people in the back when they were running away with no weapons in their hands.
Right. Well, I would say it another way as well. Once upon a time, I got very interested in understanding the legal and economic nuts and bolts of the Salem witch trials. Mm-hmm. Do you know what stopped the Salem witch trials?
Tell me.
Everybody was so busy going to court that they stopped planning and running their farms. And finally, as a group, they realized we're going to starve to death this winter if we don't grow some food.
Wow. That's good. That's the way life works. I like that. Yeah.
Right.
I was just reading this book by this woman from Roanoke about the furniture guy, I guess it is. It's about the Bassett Furniture Gang and how the Chinese murdered furniture making in the United States.
Uh-huh.
And that's that, you know, that's the same thing. Hey, get up off your rear end and go out and figure out a way to still survive. I mean,
right.
And you can't be fighting and getting subsidies and protectionism and tariffs and all this other stuff, you know, because all you're doing is creating more pollution, more corruption, more ripoff.
Right.
And go to work.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
One other interesting point on the Salem witch trials. The thing that kept it going so long was spectral evidence. Do you know what spectral evidence is?
Yeah.
So it was kind of interesting to see what kept it going and then what got it stopped. Well, that brings us to the yeah. At some point, you have to be useful. Okay, the 2016 elections. What do you think? You know, I always get very frustrated because presidential elections in this country take up a huge amount of time and energy, and you know, I have real questions about whether it's productive. But it is a time when we can at least get Americans to think about the important issues and talk about them. So what do you think are the national security issues that we're going to emerge in these elections? Is there any hope that we'll get an intelligent discussion on a national level?
I would hope so, but I don't think so. And what would that consist of? In my mind, first and foremost, it would consist of articulating some type of what I'll call, because I'm a military guy, a grand strategy to which the United States is going to hook up its economic engine. And that would also include necessarily a revival of that engine. So what you've got to do is say, what are we wanting to do in the world? And how are we going to refurbish our economy to do it? Because you aren't going to do anything of note, of consequence, until you have done just that, refurbished your economy. And that means $2, $3, maybe $4 trillion worth of expenditure on infrastructure. It means not building the old infrastructure. It means building the new infrastructure. And there's where your grand strategy comes in. What is that new infrastructure? It's got to be sustainable. It's got to be resilient. It's probably got to be metroplex oriented, that is urban oriented and not vast sprawl across the country oriented. It's got to be light rail oriented, walkable, bicyclable community oriented. It's got to be light energy footprint oriented. It's got to do away with automobiles and highways and so forth and so on. It's got to tax waste instead of wealth, at least for an interim period. It's got to do all these things that are going to prepare the U.S. economy to be hooked up to this strategy and make the strategy work. I don't see Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, Hillary Clinton, or anybody as capable of doing that or wanting to, worse.
Right. They, from what I see, and I don't really follow it, they're much more interested in serving the people who believe in monopoly, not markets.
They're more interested in power. Period. And
right.
I think that's where the power is. And I've got news for them. I've just sat on the Climate Security Working Group now for a year. I switched over from a Collaborative Institute on Oceans and Climate Security at UMass Boston. And we've been working with DOD, and we just did some sea rise charts for coastal installations like Norfolk and Mayport and so forth, San Francisco, San Diego. Let me tell you. These entities are going to spend billions of dollars for Netherlands-like water abatement apparatuses, walls and so forth and so on, or they're going to relocate. This is billions,
right.
Billions of dollars. Miami is going to have to do this. We've already got a problem in Norfolk, and we've already got a problem with Langley Air Force Base, which you wouldn't think you would have where TAC headquarters is, because the runways are being flooded. This is serious. This is real, and it's not mid-century. It's just a few years away.
I am a regular reader of The Economist. I don't know if you ever read their article, The American Aristocracy is Calcifying. It was the cover about 2 months ago.
I love the Economist covers. They are just wonderful.
But for the British to just lean back and take a whack that big and hard and front and center at American leadership, I thought, okay, well, now we're getting somewhere. There's a recent poll we put up on the site about a month ago from an AP and some associated academics, and it shows the only institution in America that has maintains popular support is the U.S. military. So when asked, when surveyed and asked, who do you have a great deal of confidence in, 50% said the U.S. military, 23% said the Supreme Court, and then it went down from there with major media at 10 and 7%. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, and if you look at Congress or the administration, it was, you know, essentially they've lost the support of the population, who's quiet about it, but, you know, I would say that, that American institutions have lost popular support of any kind, with the exception of the military.
I think so. To a certain extent, you're right, and I wonder about how much longer the bulk of the people are going to remain quiet about it, particularly if unemployment I think real unemployment in this country right now, factoring everything in, is probably more like about 15%, and probably amongst 30 and below, it's probably somewhere around 18-19%. How high does it have to get? How bad does life have to get before people start reacting? And in some way, unlike Occupy Wall Street, I mean, a really co-ed, well-led effort to change the situation, not unlike that we saw from people like Eugene Debs and others in the labor movement as it initially got going against the detritus of the 1929 fall and so forth. I'm somewhat perplexed that we have 300 and some odd 30 million people and we don't have more visible disquiet in the country. I think it's simmering.
I would tell you that the reason is that the biggest after defense, the biggest investment by government is managing discontent.
Yeah, keeping people quiet. You're right.
Everything right, keeping people quiet. And it's you know, relational database marketing has contributed massively to preventing any effective organization. But I think that the place the effective organization is going to come from is it's going to come from what I call people on the line, people in business, people in you know, in government at all levels, who know that we have to be productive. So, you know, what's interesting is the issue at the international level is becoming the same at the domestic level, which is, you know, people who know how to get things done day to day, people on the line, know that we have to be productive, know that we have to be useful. We can't just sit around and whine and insist on more government money. That's not going to work anymore. That game's up. So, you know, who knows what happens, but one of the things I know is we either grow food or we starve, so one way or another.
Yeah, I think you're right. This effort out is now relocated from Washington out to Case Western Reserve called the Strategic Innovation Lab, which is trying to do some of the things I referred to earlier. They are attracting now. I think they've given up, not totally, but they've given up wholesalely to a certain extent on Washington. They're going after governors, they're going after mayors, and they're going after CEOs, and the bigger the business, the better, in terms of its power and its money and everything. And they're attracting them now because these people are beginning to – the latest catch, I guess, was ExxonMobil. They're beginning to understand what you just said, that something needs to be done. Otherwise, we're going to stop eating.
Right. I'll tell you one of the insights. Dr. Joseph Farrell and I were at a workshop last year, and he stood up and he said, Bach, when he wrote music, would generally compose on 28 tracks. And he said, if you listen to Bach's harpsichord music, you're listening to 28 tracks. If you listen to a lot of music in America, you're listening to one track.
Yeah.
And he said, if you look at the political discussion and education in this country, Americans have been taught to think in one track or a few tracks. And yet we're living in a 28-track world. And what I keep hearing our allies come back and say to us is, look, we're managing a 28-track situation. Will you guys get out of your one-track spin and let's get to work? Because if you look at what needs to be done, it's lots of different kinds of stuff and lots of different, you know, it's complex. It's 28 tracks.
Yeah, the military's analogy was multiple chess games going on. You got to play in at least 10. And the picture we drew was of a what you might call a ceramic tower, and there was a chess game going on at each level of that tower, like about 30 chess games, and you had to play in each one of them all the time.
Right. Okay, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson is educator. Clearly, if we're going to make a turn, one of the things we have to do is help young people understand what's going on and what the issues are coming into that turn. So you've been teaching, and so you've dealt with this in a military leadership position. You've dealt with it at the highest levels of government. Now you're trying to teach the kids. What do we do to help young people sort of assume their leadership role in this situation?
I think one of the most important things we can do, and the infinitesimal contribution I'm making to this, I hope, is nonetheless along these lines, is teach them or teach them to teach themselves. That's the most important thing I've learned in education, is that when you get to this level in seminars with 8 to 10 students and so forth, they've got to teach themselves more than you lecturing to them. That what they need to become is responsible citizens. And responsible citizens means a number of things. It means they are not apathetic. It means they are concerned about serious issues confronting their country. It means that they are willing to do public service and to change the public service that they criticize and see so much wrong with. It means that they go into the Peace Corps for a year and get some experience before they come back and, say, get a master's, whatever it might be, and then go and do something, which is what most of my students are doing. Or they're going into the National Security Agency, or they're going into the CIA, or they're going into the FBI, and they're going in with their eyes open. I'm going in here to reform, as much as it is in my power to do so, this organization. I'm going in here with the idea that the National Security Agency is going to obey the law or I'm going to rat on them, that sort of thing. I mean, that's what I've been – you call it rebellion, call it revolutionary. I don't look at it that way. I look at it as training, educating. It's mostly educating. Training is skills enhancement. Educating is critical thinking. It's developing the kind of critical thinking that these young men and women need, and they've got the energy, they've got the dynamism, and they've got the capability, intellectual and otherwise, to change what we've been talking about for the better and to convince them that it can be done, whether they're going to be small business operators or like one I just sent off to Goldman Sachs. You know, he's already mm-hmm. in New York. He's already making about $150 a year, and he's feeling good about it. And I said, Harrison, you're going to come back, and you're going to do public service. If you stay at Goldman, I'm going to find you and hang you.
Well, you know, it used to be once upon a time that on Wall Street there was a tradition of public service, and people were expected to cycle through, not so they could come back and make more money, but because they could serve.
Not like Hank Paulson and Bob Rubin and Timothy Geithner to go back to make the plane feel better for their rape, pillage, and plunder when they leave.
Well, you know, it's really funny. I grew up in a culture, you know, both in my family and on Wall Street, where, you know, important people, my father reinvented the emergency room system for the country. I had an uncle who introduced transplants to South Carolina. I had another grandfather who brought penicillin to Tennessee. And the whole competition was, well, what important thing have you done? How is mankind better for your – you know, we competed about really big things. If you came to the dinner table and said, you know, I got a bonus check, everybody looked at you like, what a weenie.
Wow. You had a heck of a family.
Oh, yeah. No, I had a heck of a family. But, you know, no one ever heard their name. They were invisible. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because you didn't try and get fame. You didn't try and get money. You tried to have the biggest – you know, impact. And so looking at this culture now, I think, oh my God, if I was a young person growing up in this culture, if the only thing somebody can come up, you know, is for me to go off and make a whole bunch of money, what a pathetic.
Well,
you know, I've run companies, and when you tell people our goal is to make money, they don't know what to do, and they get depressed and tired. Do you know what I mean? It's not a, it's a measurement. You know, it's like telling a home builder his goal is to get the most hammers possible.
Right, right. Well, I had a debate. I won't call it a debate. We had a discussion in my seminar yesterday. John Henry Cardinal Newman's original conception of the university, I put forward, and I said, now, think about it for a moment. This Flat Hat article here, that's the William & Mary student paper, this Flat Hat article about choosing your university based on how much money you're going to make and how much money it costs you to go to your university. Now, I'm not going to defend tuition, but I am going to stand up here and tell you that the purpose of learning to think critically is not to make money, necessarily. You've got to have an educated public to have a democracy, period. If you don't have an educated public, you don't have a democracy.
Well, you don't have a civilization.
On a broader scale, okay. Absolutely right.
Okay, so I'm gonna tell you my weak spot. If you want to make me spitting mad to the point of incoherence, all you have to do is tell me that, or ask me the question, why is nobody doing anything? And when you get under my skin that way, you get a big speech about that is the most ridiculous thing I've heard. And the one example I always use for people who are fearless in Washington and in the country for policy issues is Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. So I have to thank you because you have been my battering ram for many years when somebody says nobody's doing anything. And frankly, I don't know how you get away with as being as fearless as you do, but thank God you do. So keep it up. And if there's anything we can do to help. Yeah, when we allocate more money for infrastructure, put some of it in for telecommunications systems.
Oh, don't get started on that.
No. Notice I didn't go there. Yeah, there are some of us who would like a telecommunications system that serves the customer and small business. Anyway, okay, well, Colonel Wilkerson, I can't thank you enough. In closing, just give us a few words about how we keep up with you and keep up with your work.
Oh, wow. I hope everyone will buy my book when it comes out. I'm trying to finish it. I hope I finish it this year. I don't even know what the title's going to be yet, but it's going to be all about how Black Eisenhower, if you will, rose to the pinnacle of military and then diplomatic power in the United States, and at the same time aided and abetted, along with his friend, the Army colonel, the completion of the state-building effort that followed World War II and culminated in what we have today, the national security state. Other places where you might hear about me are with regard to Cuba, with regard to Iran and negotiations and so forth. You know, from time to time, I'm going to New Hampshire next week. I'm leaving tomorrow for New Hampshire and then Iowa and then Texas to talk about the military-industrial complex and what it's doing to our economy and to our world. The most prolific myth in this country, promoted by everyone who has anything to do with that complex, is that spending on the military is economically productive. That's nonsense. It isn't. It's necessary to a certain extent for our security, and we should accept that, but it's not productive for the economy, and we should try to trim it when and where we can, and we should particularly try to trim things that aren't even productive for the military.
Right. Absolutely. Well, Colonel Wilkerson, thank you again. Have a great day. And let us know as soon as the book is available for order, okay?
I'll do that. Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.